Our next guest on Downtown has been telling the story of America through his wonderful documentary films for nearly four decades. Along the way, producing classics like The Civil War, Prohibition, The Dust Bowl, Jackie Robinson, The Vietnam War from 2 years ago. And this time around, he's turned his attention to country music and chronicles the 90-year history of the medium in an 8-part, 16-hour series that comes to public broadcasting on September 15th. We had a chance to catch up earlier today with Ken Burns to talk about country music.
Hey, Rich, how are you?
Doing just great. Thank you so much for making time for us, as always.
No, other way around. Thank you.
I've been immersed all 16 hours the last few nights.
All 16? God bless you. We're all grateful. I'm in a car with Dayton Duncan and Julie Dunphy, my two co-producers. Dayton also wrote the script. And we are traveling down the Central Valley of California on our way to Fresno and Bakersfield to honor, their Maddox brothers and Rose and Buck Owens and Merle Haggard and Dwight Yoakam by going out off the normal beaten path of a promotional tour and doing stuff in Fresno and Bakersfield.
As somebody who teaches history, but my first job was as a country DJ back in the mid-1970s, this was like a homecoming for me, and it was just wonderful. I think of a couple of wonderful quotes that come up in the film. The great Harlan Howard, who says, "Country music is three chords and the truth."
That's the most important one. I didn't mean to interrupt you, Rich, but no. That's the most important one. That's why it's in a central position in the introduction. That says it all.
And then Merle Haggard says, "Country music is about the things we believe that we can't see."
You've done it. You might as well just go write your thing, do your whatever you're going to do with yourself, because you got it. You figured out. You broke the key. And you're talking about stuff in the first 6 minutes of this film. Both of those are exactly right. The line from Harlan Howard that's spoken by the narrator and Merle Haggard, the things that we believe in but can't see.
And yet I understand that the story of country music was more complicated perhaps than you thought it would be when you first began the project.
Can I tell you that there hasn't been a project we've worked on in 40 years that isn't so tremendously more complicated than what we came in believing? What we have to do is shed our biases and our baggage, and more importantly, shed the conventional wisdom we think we have about a particular subject. And it's only by resetting to zero that we then permit these things to happen. And because we never stop researching and we never stop writing, we are permitted to constantly adjust over the many years it takes us that we insist we have to do this, to change the film as we learn more and more information about something. And, filmmakers are notorious for not, once a scene is working, is not wanting to touch it. Oh, that's too good. Let's leave it alone. But in fact, we've learned just to sort of sigh and say it's complicated. We have a neon sign in our editing room that says that, and then set about to make that perfect thing even better because of the contradictory, information we have. Roseanne says about her father, Johnny Cash, that, he could hold two contradictory things at the same time and believe in them with a kind of equal force. And so as we as storytellers and filmmakers know that at the heart of a good story is often that fact that you have to hold two opposing things and not choose either one of them, but understand that the complexities of life, which country music mirrors and reflects so well despite the three chords business, that truth is filled with contradiction and undertow, and that's human life, and that's why country music's so effective.
I thought it was fascinating early in the film when you discuss the origins of the three principal instruments of country music and how that in many ways reflects the diversity of country when you talk about the banjo, the fiddle, and the guitar.
Yep. Well, everything about American music is mongrel, right? There's nothing pure about it. You'll take music that has a kind of homogeneity from a country or a continent, and then you'll do something. You'll mix it with something else, and it will be, great. You know what I'm saying?
Oh, absolutely. The role of radio was also huge in the rise of country music with the superstations, the WSB in Atlanta, WLS in Chicago with the old barn dance, and also WSM in Nashville, of course.
That's exactly right. I think we wouldn't have had country music sort of catch on as quickly and as, so firmly in everyone's heart if there hadn't been radio disseminating it, particularly in the Depression when people couldn't buy a record. They could listen to it for free. And so you find the one, quote, luxury, I would suggest it's not a luxury but a necessity in the poorest of families would be a radio that would connect them to the world. I made a film on the early days of radio, and the great radio commentator Norman Corwin said that radio abolished loneliness. And that's because it may have been possible for you to hear Hank Williams saying, "I'm so lonesome I could cry," and you could cry too, and in those tears you would have a connection to somebody else.
One of the overarching themes in this wonderful film is the role of women, starting with Sarah Carter, and then all the way through to Patsy Cline, Kitty Wells, Patsy Montana, singer-songwriters who were way ahead of their time, like Loretta Lynn and Dolly Parton. Women have always been an incredibly integral part of music.
This was a stunning and unexpected discovery for us, too, and that the two foundational folks in country music are arguably, you know, Mother Maybelle and Sarah Carter. Sarah with her voice and Mother Maybelle with her guitar picking, which has influenced everybody else. And all as the list you just gave us, it goes all the way through. And many of the issues and conflicts of today are mirrored in the generations of women who had to, you know, be that much better. And avoid that, you know, difficult executive, and all the things we're talking about with Me Too have been there for the beginning. And so we love the fact that Loretta may not call herself a feminist or may not speak about women's liberation, but she's talking about these themes well before anybody in rock or folk is doing. And that's pretty impressive. And so, yeah, that knocked our socks off.
We're talking with Ken Burns here on Downtown. The Carter family, the first family of country music, like so many country artists, their lives in many ways were a country song as well. I didn't know a lot of the background there, but what a fascinating story they are.
You can't believe it. And in fact, they represent the Sunday morning of the early beginnings of country music. They are supposedly about mother and family and the home. And this, and Jimmy Rogers is the opposite of this, the Saturday night and the rogue, the scamp, the sort of screwing up, the people for whom, you know, you have to go to church the next morning to sort of reconcile your sins of the previous night. But then, of course, within the story of the Carter family is a melodrama, you know, of incomparable dimensions that sort of belie the outward purity of the story, and that's very human too. And we don't need to judge it, we can just accept it. We've all been through what they've been through, we've all have experienced, or we know people who have experienced what they went through. And then when you get to the story, no one in Hollywood would invent the final chapter, or at least the cementing of Sarah Carter's future. And you know, you and I are not going to give it away to your listeners, but this is about as great a story as you could possibly come. And, oh, by the way, it's in episode 2, you know, and there's many more episodes to come.
Country music in its early days was still largely regional. Can you explain how World War II helped to nationalize country music?
Well, World War II did nationalize it, and that's a really important thing. First of all of American music is a mix. And so when a country mobilizes and goes to war, you do that mix with people. So people from every corner of the country find themselves with people from regions they might never in their lifetime get to meet. And in fact, it's World War II that begins the incredible mobility of Americans who begin to sort of cross-pollinate with everybody else. And so when we think in that superficial, conventional way about what World War II is, the music we always use as the soundtrack to it is the swing music of Benny Goodman and Glenn Miller and that sort of stuff. Mm. And that was popular. But as popular, if not more popular, was country music and the various songs that were sung. And so we're, you know, Patsy Montana, I'll Wait for You, and Elton Britt, you know, there's the Star Spangled Banner waving somewhere. These are all the songs that everybody heard, and it helped spread. I mean, certainly radio is helping, particularly the stations like WSM with those signals. But this is the beginning of the nationalization of country music, and you're going to come back from World War II, and you're going to stop calling it hillbilly. You're going to eventually stop calling it country and western. You're finally just going to say what it is, country. And by that time, that's true. It's across the country. It doesn't just mean rural, which is, of course, the obvious and literal understanding of it. It came from rural places. But it's so interesting that the story of its extraordinary growth is tied as much to cities as it is to the rural areas from which it sprang.
That's something that I think people may find very, very interesting, especially from the first episode, is how the earliest parts of country music actually sort of came out of the city of Atlanta.
Yeah, so Ralph Peer has been recording race music. That means rhythm and blues. That means Bessie Smith. And he's also doing a lot of ethnic records, you know, Chinese and European, French and Italian and German and Slovakian music. And he wonders whether there might be a market for, you know, this old hill country music, old-time hill country music. And, of course, there is. And in 1923, he records Fiddlin' John Carson in Atlanta, who's a mill worker who came from the hills, but has been very much urbanized, and he's willing to drop all of the urban, I'm not sure I want to say sophistication, but at least to adopt that hillbilly posture. He adds fiddlin' without the G to his nickname, to his moniker, and that takes it off. And then four years later, in 1927 in Bristol, Tennessee, just across the street from Bristol, literally across the street from Bristol, Virginia, he records the Carter Family and Jimmy Rogers. And they don't sound anything alike. Jimmy's Saturday night, and the Carter Family, as we discussed, are Sunday morning. And it's off to the races. And it's going to be, from then on, picking up all different flavors. But what's key in the early days that's not spoken about too much, which our series reflects in every episode, is that there's always an African dimension, African-American dimension to this. You know, the banjos from Africa, but A.P. Carter travels around with Leslie Riddle. A.P. can remember the words, but can't remember the melody, and Riddle can't. You know, the influences of a black artist on Jimmy Rogers and Hank Williams and Bill Monroe and Johnny Cash and everybody, it's all there. So it's always been a mix from the very beginning, and we're thrilled to sort of share this inclusive story. It wouldn't be American music unless it was a melting pot of all sorts of influences, you know, from church music to traveling medicine shows, to minstrelsy, to Tin Pan Alley, to all sorts of things go in to make up what we call country music, but also, I could say, jazz. And also rhythm and blues later on. So they've all got the mix. That's the characteristic of any American form. And, of course, rhythm and blues and country are going to be the parents of rockabilly and therefore rock and roll.
So many great artists are portrayed in this film. But to me, the heroic figure of the story is Johnny Cash, who brought together so many styles, embraced artists from all genres, and could never be anything less than true to himself.
That's exactly right, and I think that he is the polymath, the patriarch of it all, who arcs across our series, because he very conveniently, for us storytellers, marries into the Carter family there at the get-go, there at the Big Bang, and of course it is death that is the last story of our series, and is the bookend of what we're doing. And I think it has to do with he is the ultimate country person, because he understood that it was never one thing. So he is going to prisons and saying, "You mean something to me." He's going to Native American reservations and saying, "You are not less of a human being than me." He's looking at the poor and the downtrodden. He's speaking to the dark side as well as to the light side. He's including a gospel song in every performance that he does, every one of his television shows at the, you know, against the wishes of the producers. Includes a gospel show. He's bringing on new talent. He's reaching into folk. He has a friendship with Bob Dylan. He is the person who is restless and unsatisfied, and he is symbolically represents that energy and that appetite that's been at the heart of country music from the beginning. And that's not then to take away from the Merle Haggards and the Dolly Partons and the Hank Williamses and the Patsy Cline's, but just to say that, you know, he stands out in proud relief as perhaps country's greatest ambassador.
I've read that you've said you're a convert to country music now. Was there one story, one performer that pulled you in? What was it that drew you into this world?
We drink the Kool-Aid on every project we do, but I don't think we've drunk it more fully and with deep satisfaction than we've done here. I knew some. I worked in a record store. My daddy and my granddaddy sang to me what you would call country songs and folk country songs and hill country songs. My people come from the Appalachian Mountains of Virginia, Burnsville, to be precise, still there in Virginia. It wasn't my music. But when we start a project, we dive into it, into the deep end, and we love it now. And I'm so happy that it's in my life. And I have, as Charlie Pride says in the opening, you know, a song for every mood. Even though one might make you cry, you feel better for crying, he says. And that's the cathartic power of country music is so pervasive and so exciting that I can't wait to share it with the rest of the country. And as we've experienced bringing people into our editing room during the process, the folks that know a lot about it and love it, he'll say, wow, I had no idea that that's why that song was written, or what the circumstances of that person's biography, or how great that songwriter was, or whatever it might be. That there was even something new for the most ardent of country fans. And for those people who say, well, I don't know much, they say, I didn't realize that I did know more than I did, because how wide country music's embrace is. And for those who say, you know, I have a friend of mine, a dear friend, who says, you know, Ken, I've loved all the things you've done, but country music, I don't know. And then he sat down as we had a screening of it, and he was in a puddle at the end, and now all he listens to is country music, and he's still abject and apologetic that he could have possibly been, you know, proclaimed any apostasy before that moment. And that's exciting to us. And we hope that, you know, we all understand that somebody might come in with Emmylou Harris or the outlaw movement, or maybe from the get-go with Jimmy Rogers or the Carter family, or certainly no one. If somebody doesn't like Hank Williams, then we can't help you. you know what I mean? Or Johnny or Merle or Dolly or Loretta. These are all the great composers and singer-songwriters of this genre. But we're just so thrilled to be able to share the backstory. This isn't the reading of the telephone book. We'll leave people out that it was painful for us to leave out in order to tell a story that we hope will bring people in and send them, to the music that they want to find out, and send them to the folks that maybe only have a mention here, but they want to know more about. We're so excited that we'll be able to share that with the rest of the country soon.
Ken, the amount of interview footage for a project of this scope must just be massive. Beyond what you use for the actual documentary, how important is it for you and your team to catalog and preserve that information?
That's huge. You know, we've just taken the full interviews, not the edited interviews, the full interviews and their transcripts, 101 people, more than 175 hours, and given it to the Country Music Hall of Fame, so it will be available for scholars and students in the future. But, you know how maple syrup is made, 40 gallons of sap to make 1 gallon of maple syrup. We did 101 interviews, 175 hours. We looked at 100,000 photographs for the 3,300 we have in the final film. We had 1,000 hours of footage that we collected. All of it had to be boiled down to the 16-plus hours of this series. So, our cutting room floor is filled with good stuff and very, very hard choices of what storytelling is about. And so we're thrilled that we are able to suggest in the excellent companion book that Dayton Duncan has written and in the DVD extras that we have, but also in the kind of stories that we initiate and can't completely tell, that people can go and go look up that memoir or go look up that story, or more importantly, just go get that music. And that's what we're very excited about. This is not the last word. We hope this is the first word.
Before we let you go, I did want to ask one quick question about the process, the making of the film. I read a while back Peter Coyote, who serves again as your narrator and does such a wonderful job, likes to do cold readings. Is that right?
Cold readings. That's exactly right. And he's really good at it. So here's the thing. I'm what's called the scratch narrator. That means from the very first time, after maybe two drafts of the script on paper, I'll read it. And then this becomes a radio play. We're not going to waste the editor's time putting in images. We're just going to kind of listen to it, see the talking head, but listen to basically look at a black screen until we've worked on it. And so every time we change an to a the, I go in the booth and reread it. It makes no sense to bring Peter in early, right? Mm. So when we're 98% of the way through, then we sort of say, let's bring in Peter. And not only does he read it cold, he doesn't read it to picture either. So we don't care whether he hits the same marks that I did. The editors go back and readjust to him. It's like, you know, a hand-me-down suit, right? I've been wearing it. Then he puts it on and, of course, makes it look much better. But we'll change a cut to fit him. And that's really important to us, that meaning is everything. And Peter brings this extraordinary meaning, and it's often take one or take two that we're using in most of the stuff. And we're willing to break it up, phrase at a time. We hold these truths from take seven, to be self-evident from take four, that all men are created equal from take one. You know, that's the way we cut this stuff up and choose a narrator in the booth. But with Peter, you can sometimes, you'll read it and we'll look at each other and say, well, will you do it again for the insurance company? You know, just in case we lose this perfect take one. He's great, and he takes the meaning that's there in my imperfect voice and puts it in this great set of pipes and even adds more meaning to it. And we bless him. He's our brother. We've worked with him for decades now, and we can't imagine leaving home without him for most films.
There's a wonderful line by Vince Gill late in the series. He says, all I ever wanted out of music was to be moved, and you have done this.
Hey, Rich. You're killing me. You're killing me. Every single thing that you've brought up is you've gone right to the heart of what it is, whether it was the Harlan Howard quote or what Merle says in the intro or what Vince says in the last episode about moving. That's exactly what it is. The emotional archaeology that has always been at the heart of the work that we've done, uninterested in just excavating dry dates and facts and events, and not interested in the baser emotions of sentimentality and nostalgia, but real deep emotion is what Vince wants, what Wynton Marsalis means when he said this is the art of the invisible, and that art tells the tale of us coming together. It's the connection with others that we feel at that deep emotional level, and that's the heart of our series, and the fact that you found that means that, at least for you, we've done a good job.
Well, our thanks to you, to Dayton, to Julie, and everybody involved in this wonderfully poignant, moving, at times funny, and remarkable series, Country Music, coming to PBS in September. And as always, Ken, thank you for spending some time with us to talk about it.
I'll pass on your compliments to them. They deserve them as much as me. And we're so thrilled to be able to share it with your audience. And thanks again so much, Rich, for watching all of it and for asking such thoughtful questions and getting it.
Great Ken Burns. Yeah, series is so good. Can't talk enough about it. Country Music. Got to wait till September, though, unless you want to come over to Carrie's house or my house, and we'll let you watch our copy.
I know Loretta is very anxious to watch the rest of it because we didn't get the review copy in until last week. In 16 hours, you needed to watch it. So I didn't have the time, full disclosure, to see all of it, but I did watch a quarter of it. Last night, my poor wife, though, has been going into work at 5:30 and was trying to make it as far as she could into it. It just absolutely draws you in almost immediately.
And he's just such a great storyteller. And it covers country music from its start, the origins back in the 20s until the mid-1990s. And kind of the rise of Garth Brooks is sort of the end of the story. And I saw someone asked Ken recently why that, and why didn't you continue up to the present day? And he said, well, we're historians, and you need a little time in the rearview mirror for things to become history. So this seemed like a good bookend. And as he mentioned, Johnny Cash and his late career return to prominence, winning a Grammy Award and the acclaimed albums he did with Rick Rubin is kind of the last part of the story, but it got so good. And our thanks to Ken for giving us about 25 minutes of time while he was on his way to Bakersfield, which was, that's pretty cool.
Very appropriate because, yeah, that's one of those spots that each generation of country music seemed to come out of a different area and get influenced differently by that area.
And we'll talk, well, the good, bad, and ugly, we're going to talk about it some more, and also some of the history that's involved in a project like this that's taken him some 8 years to do.